Having covered the issues of Israel's potential motive to kill President Kennedy, James Angleton's close and unsupervised relationship with Israel, and the Permandex Meyer Lansky web of connections and intrigue, we now have just a few remaining topics to address before we have a thorough understanding of the core arguments that are relied upon by those who believe that Israel was behind the JFK assassination. In this final episode of the Israel series, we revisit Jack Ruby once again, and then turn our focus to the Mossad, newly declassified documents about Israel, whether a Cuban exile with foreknowledge implicated Israel, and alleged Israeli financing of Oliver Stone's film JFK. Then, we attempt to answer the big question of whether Israel was behind President Kennedy's murder.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a part of it.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? The mission answers, he acted alone.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. We last focused on Jack Ruby in episodes 84 and 85, with an emphasis on his organized crime-adjacent biography. But there's a Jewish mob link that was conspicuously missing: Ruby's alleged ties to gangster Mickey Cohen. Cohen had been Bugsy Siegel's bodyguard, and when Siegel was killed in 1947, Cohen took over his rackets, making him Meyer Lansky's West Coast representative. In 1946, when Gary Ween was an investigator of the Los Angeles District Attorney's Bureau of Investigation, Ween had Mickey Cohen under regular surveillance. Ween claimed that he saw Ruby twice in Hollywood. The first time was in 1946, when Ruby was riding with Mickey Cohen in his black limo. The second time was in 1947, when Ween introduced himself to Ruby at a bar called Harry's Place. Ween told Ruby that he was a police officer, and Ruby then introduced himself by name and said that he was from Chicago. While trailing Cohen, investigator Ween noticed that he spent a lot of time at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel lunch counter taking orders from a, quote, weird-looking little guy. After taking photos with a telescopic lens back to the office, Ween found out that the man directing Cohen was Irgun leader Menachem Begin. In his memoirs, Mickey Cohen confirmed that he helped the Irgun raise money across America. Cohen said that then-President Harry Truman looked the other way and allowed Cohen and the Irgun to steal American equipment and weapons that were no longer in use after World War II. Another connection point between Jack Ruby and Mickey Cohen was Ruby's friend Al Gruber, who was Cohen's associate in Hollywood. Gruber was one of the first phone calls that Ruby made shortly after Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested. Ruby hadn't seen Gruber in 10 years, but Gruber came to visit him in Dallas in November of 1963, before the assassination. And Ruby may have had contacts with Meyer Lansky himself. At the time Ruby killed Oswald, his friend Louis McWillie was working at the Thunderbird Hotel in Las Vegas, which was owned in part by Meyer Lansky and his brother Jake. This means that Louis McWillie was working for the Lanskys when Ruby made 7 phone calls to him in 1963, as noted by Professor Peter Dale Scott. There's speculation that when Ruby said he visited the Fox brothers at the Tropicana Casino in Cuba, he may have actually visited the Lansky brothers. There's also an FBI report from Blaney Mack Johnson, who we previously mentioned in episode 84, that said Ruby owned an interest in a nightclub and gambling establishment with Meyer Lansky and Jake Lansky. We can't talk about whether Israel had the ability to pull off the JFK assassination without addressing the capabilities of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency that was regularly engaged in covert action. There were several documented Mossad assassinations around 1963. In September of 1962, a West German rocket scientist who was working on the Egyptian missile program was abducted and never found. Swiss police later arrested two Mossad agents for the crime. In November of 1962, a mail bomb was sent to an Egyptian rocket factory in the United Arab Emirates, disfiguring and blinding the secretary who opened it. Both of these actions were part of the Mossad's Operation Damocles. In addition, Mossad operative Yitzhak Shamir headed a special hit squad from 1955 until 1964, which, quote, carried out attacks on perceived enemies and suspected Nazi war criminals. Shamir had been the leader of the Stern Gang, also known as Lehi, who worked with the Irgun to commit various acts of violence. Shamir later became Prime Minister of Israel. The most famous mission carried out by Shamir's group was the May 1960 abduction of Adolf Eichmann, the man who oversaw the logistics of Germany's mass murder of Jews during the Holocaust. The Mossad abducted the war criminal and brought him back to Israel to face charges, where he was eventually sentenced to death by hanging. While we are aware of the Operation Damocles actions, the capture of Adolf Eichmann, and a few other assassinations that were later admitted to by Shamir, the Mossad was engaged in covert operations. So it's not like we're going to find the definitive list of Mossad assassinations in the newspapers or on Wikipedia. It seems clear that the Mossad had the ability to pull off international assassinations around the time of 1963. But the mere ability to pull it off is not the same thing as proof of actually doing it. So what exactly is the theory of how Israel killed JFK? From what I can surmise, it's best articulated by its leading proponent, Michael Collins Piper. Piper argues that in David Ben-Gurion's final days as prime minister, he ordered the Mossad assassination team leader Yitzhak Shamir to kill President Kennedy. In support of that theory, Piper points to French intelligence officer Pierre Neuville, who opined that at least one of the assassins was hired by the Mossad through the deputy chief of the French intelligence service, Colonel Georges de Lanurien. Neuville said that Colonel de Lanurien was at a meeting with James Angleton in Langley, Virginia, on the day of the JFK assassination. That is big if true. These show-stopping allegations all come from former French intelligence officer Pierre Neuville. Piper also cites to Angleton's HSCA testimony for the proposition that Angleton confirmed this claim about meeting with Colonel de Lanurien on November 22, 1963. Upon reading the entire transcript, I wasn't able to find it. According to Angleton biographer Tom Mangold, OAS mercenary Jean Suetre approached the CIA in June of 1963 with information that a communist mole was inside of French intelligence. Given Angleton's role as head of counterintelligence, it's likely that he was aware of this report. For many JFK assassination researchers, the name Jean Suetre has long been among those mentioned as a potential Dealey Plaza shooter. According to a declassified CIA memo from April 1, 1964, the French government believed that Swetra had been in Fort Worth, Texas on the morning of November 22, 1963, and that he was then expelled from the United States. We know this from a document from the French government asking for more information on Swetra because they wanted to know if Swetra was in Mexico when Charles de Gaulle had an upcoming visit scheduled. To further complicate matters, Swetra later suggested that another Frenchman, Michael Mertz, often used his name, and he may have been the one who was actually in Fort Worth that day. According to Piper, Michael Mertz was part of Meyer Lansky's French Connection heroin route with the Corsican Mafia. Author Dick Russell notes that House Select Committee on Assassinations investigator Mike Ewing told him that Jean Swetra, quote, was connected with people involved with murders or political assassinations in Europe. He was most definitely in the same circles of OAS-connected killers. The agency admits that its own handlers were afraid of them, that they were not following CIA directives and were off on assassination plots of their own. The CIA was trying to keep them on a leash because it was afraid to cut them off. So Jean Swetra is not the kind of guy you like to see arrested and deported from Texas that day. Thanks to recent document declassifications, we now know much more about Israel's role in post-Castro Cuba. During James Angleton's testimony to the Church Committee, he mentions that he put CIA officer Bill Harvey into contact with the Israelis, quote, during the Cuban business. In the previously redacted version of this testimony, we didn't know who Angleton had introduced Harvey to or for what purpose. We can now see that Angleton introduced Harvey to, quote, Israeli operational people on the Cuban business. In the same hearing, Angleton clarified that the Cuban business meant, quote, clandestine services activity in Cuba. Angleton went on to say, quote, it seemed to me that both the Cubans and the Soviets knew everything that was being planned. In other words, the Soviets and the Cubans knew what the Americans were going to do before they did it. Angleton continued, quote, so when Bill took over the Cuban business, then I decided that I would try to help him out by getting him a source totally unknown to everybody. And I went to the Israelis, and I had them assign a man to Havana, whom I happened to know very well. He could speak Russian and the Balkan countries' languages. He was sent to Havana, and the communications were from him in a one-time pattern. I mean, total security from Havana to Tel Aviv to me, and from me to Bill. No one knew of his existence or his identity except Harvey and myself. And of course, Dick Helms. So Angleton had a secret Israeli spy put in Havana to get information on the Soviets there. And according to Angleton, the Israeli spy did a really good job. Angleton said, quote, his production was without question the greatest production there was. When Angleton was asked whether Bill Harvey ever attempted to use Angleton's Israeli agent in Havana to try to kill Fidel Castro, Angleton responded, quote, he knows that I would have cut his throat. Chronological age is your birthday. Biological age is how old your body really is, and it's the strongest predictor of disease risk and mortality. True Diagnostic gives you your biological age and health markers, plus a simple personalized 90-day plan after analyzing over a million data points. Their True Age test measures longevity and aging and includes Symphony Age, tracking the health of 11 organ systems, like your heart, brain, lungs, immune system, and more. The test also gives you the top three things that you can do right now to slow down or reverse the aging process for you specifically. You can order online, and the kit ships right to your door. It's just a quick, simple finger prick at home, and then you drop it in the prepaid return package. Your only job is to follow the three recommendations for 90 days, and then you can retest to check your progress. True Diagnostic offers a one-time kit, or you can get a subscription of 4 tests every 90 days. So check out True Diagnostic. They use advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million biomarkers, and they help you identify the 3 most important things you can do over the next 3 months to make your health better. They're trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, Solving JFK listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code JFK20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use code JFK20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com. You've heard me talk about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. I'm talking about Mood.com, which has created an entire line of functional gummies and flower crafted for your ideal mood, made with 100% federally legal THC. Not only that, but they'll deliver them directly to your doorstep so you can have your own clandestine herbal journey. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. What makes Mood.com's gummies different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. But their flower is what really blows me away. They partner with small, family-owned American farms who are custom cultivating their bud with unique terpene profiles. So you can choose a strain to help you feel more social, chilled out, or even more focused and productive. Best of all, not only does Mood.com stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you can get 20% off your first order with code JFK. So head to Mood.com and browse their amazing selection of functional gummies and flower and find the perfect one for whatever you're dealing with. Remember, use promo code JFK at checkout to save 20% off your first order. In addition to Angleton's church committee testimony, there's another potential link between Israel and Cuba in the form of a statement from Cuban exile Homer Echeverria, who was a Chicago-based bus driver involved in the anti-Castro movement. In September of 1963, gunrunner Tom Mosley approached Echeverria about selling him some machine guns to be used by his Cuban exile associates to invade Cuba. On the day before President Kennedy was assassinated, Thursday, November 21st, Mosley once again got in touch with Echeverria about buying machine guns. In response to Mosley's offer to sell weapons, Echeverria said, quote, "We now have plenty of money. Our new backers are Jews, as soon as we or they take care of Kennedy." Echeverria also told Mosley that before the purchase was made, his superiors would have to confirm that Mosley was not a CIA agent. Mosley met with the Chicago Secret Service and FBI about this incident on Tuesday, November 26, 1963. 2 days later, the Secret Service observed Mosley as he picked up Echeverria in his car. But in order to not be detected, the Secret Service agents didn't follow Mosley and Echeverria. Mosley reported that after driving a short distance, Echeverria asked him to pull over, at which point another Cuban who he did not know got in the car. That Cuban said that they would decide whether to buy the weapons from Mosley based on his response to 2 questions. What did he think of the Kennedy assassination? And who did he know in Cuba that could vouch for him? After Mosley's responses to those questions were satisfactory, he didn't care about JFK and he knew a guy in Cuba named Ponce, the unnamed Cuban told him that they would place a classified ad in the newspaper with a code name and a time and number to call when they wanted to speak with him again about the weapons sale. Mosley added that he believed Echeverria's group was backed by, quote, hoodlum elements. Specifically, he thought the group was tied to Paulino Sierra Martinez and the Junta of the Government of Cuba in Exile, or the JGCE. You may recall from episode 82 that the JGCE was funded by Johnny Rosselli. Echeverria, for his part, was a member of the anti-Castro 30th of November group, which was backed by the JGCE. As far as we know, Mosley was never contacted again by Echeverria or his group. Although the Secret Service recommended further investigation, the FBI stated that, quote, the Cuban group in question was probably not involved in illegal activities. However, given the timing of Echeverria's statement the day before the assassination, the HSCA report highlighted that, quote, Secret Service was initially reluctant to accept this position since it had developed evidence that illegal acts were, in fact, involved. Then, on November 29, 1963, President Johnson created the Warren Commission and gave the FBI primary investigative responsibility in the assassination. In other words, the Secret Service was taking the Echeverria foreknowledge claim seriously, but the FBI took over the investigation and they did not take the claim seriously, so it was never thoroughly investigated. Another claim often raised by proponents of Israel as the primary culprit in the JFK assassination is that Oliver Stone's iconic film, JFK, was financially backed by an Israeli agent. I scoffed at this claim when I first heard it, but it turns out to be true. Longtime Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan, who has produced over 130 films, is listed as an executive producer on Oliver Stone's JFK. That's not the only famous film Milchan's been involved with. He also produced Pretty Woman, Natural Born Killers, Heat, Fight Club, 12 Years a Slave, and Bohemian Rhapsody, just to name a few. In November of 2013, Arnon Milchan gave an interview to Israeli television and confirmed that he had worked for an Israeli agency that negotiated weapons deals and supported Israel's secret nuclear project. Milchan noted in the interview how much of a challenge it was to overcome his reputation as an arms dealer when making the leap into Hollywood, saying, quote, in Hollywood, they don't like working with an arms dealer, ideologically, with someone who lives off selling machine guns and killing. Instead of someone talking to me about a script, I had to spend half an hour explaining that I'm not an arms dealer. If people knew how many times I risked my life back and forth, again and again, for my country. The allegation against Oliver Stone is that he allowed Milchan to infiltrate his film and to direct the ultimate conclusion of the film away from anything that could be tied back to Israel. So let's zoom in on the precise role that Milchan had with Israel. He was working for the Bureau of Scientific Relations, LECEM, that wrapped up operations in 1987. More importantly, Oliver Stone was asked about this issue when I was standing next to him in the halls of Congress after his April 1st, 2025 congressional testimony. Here's that exchange, courtesy of reporter Sam Husseini.
You, Mr. Stone, have talked in recent years about how Kennedy tried to prevent Israel from getting nuclear weapons. Now, the executive producer of JFK, the movie, has said that he was a spy for Israel and that he helped it procure nuclear weapons. When did you know that the executive producer on JFK was an Israeli spy?
Afterward, I made the film.
When?
And he did not interfere in any way on the film. In fact, he was not the primary force. He came in as a partner with Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers was the one who was making the film with me. And they let me go to say what I had to say. So Arnon Milchan came in, frankly, on the back side of the case, didn't express any opinions, and frankly, I knew he was an Israeli, a big shot in Israel, and he probably had some intelligence ties, but I didn't know specifically what he had done.
Where does that leave us on the question of Israel's involvement in the JFK assassination? When it comes to motive, we clearly established four areas of tension between the Kennedy administration and Israel. The mandatory registration of pro-Israel lobbying groups, Kennedy's alleged anti-Israel bias, Kennedy's insistence on following through with UN Resolution 194, and most importantly, Kennedy's determination to stop Israel from getting a nuclear weapon. This potential motivation for seeking Kennedy's ouster is highlighted by the strong pro-Israel positions taken by Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson. Now, just because it would have been in Israel's interest to take Kennedy out of office, it doesn't mean that the Israeli government ordered the hit. We would still have to establish means, opportunity, and ideally have some proof that they actually followed through with it. When it comes to whether Israel was capable of killing Kennedy, they had the Mossad, an intelligence agency that was deadly, efficient, and was involved in state-sponsored killings during the time of the Kennedy assassination. But in my view, there's no reliable evidence linking the Mossad to the assassination. It's clear that Israel was not in control of Lee Harvey Oswald's CIA file. Thus, Israel could not be the one who set Oswald up. That's where James Angleton's airtight relationship with Israeli officials comes in. Even Michael Collins Piper says that Angleton was not controlled by the Israelis. James Angleton's too close and unsupervised relationship with the Israelis led to nuclear proliferation in Israel that was against the policy of the United States. Still, Angleton's mere relationship with Israel does not constitute proof that Israel was behind the JFK assassination. Let's look at Piper's argument of how he says Israel actually carried out the assassination. Piper claims that Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion ordered the hit in the summer of 1963 after he had resigned from office. Then, Ben-Gurion told Yitzhak Shamir of the Mossad to kill Kennedy. According to Piper, Shamir then contacted French intelligence colonel Georges de Lanurien, who procured an assassin. The evidence for all of this is what French intelligence officer Pierre Neuville told Piper. To add further confusion, the assassin that Piper theorizes was hired by the Mossad was Jean Suetre, a mercenary who, even if he was a shooter in Dallas, could just as well have been hired by the CIA or the Mafia for that matter. I still have some questions about Permandex and its ties to intelligence, but I don't believe that Permandex having Louis Bloomfield as a lawyer and using the same bank that Israel used, BCI, is proof that Israel is behind the JFK assassination. On the other hand, Jack Ruby meeting with Mickey Cohen is absolutely believable. I believe Gary Ween that Ruby was with Cohen in 1947 in LA. After all, Cohen's lawyer, Melvin Belli, would later be Jack Ruby's lawyer, and his girlfriend, Candy Barr, regularly performed at Ruby's club. With Ruby, it now seems very likely that he killed Oswald on orders from someone. The big question is who? I do not find the theory persuasive that David Ben-Gurion ordered the murder of President Kennedy. Yes, Ben-Gurion had some real policy issues with Kennedy and probably didn't like him as a person. But the evidence that he ordered the JFK assassination, aside from motive, is limited to Angleton visiting him in person after he resigned and a statement from former French intelligence officer Pierre Neuville to Michael Collins Piper about Yitzhak Shamir hiring an assassin through the French intelligence service. Big claims require big evidence, and for me, I just don't see it here. However, Cuban exile Homer Echeverria saying that Kennedy would be killed now that his group had Jewish financial backers should not be ignored. Of course, having Jewish backers isn't the same as having the State of Israel as a backer. Echeverria's exile group was also backed by Johnny Rosselli, which puts him squarely in the mix of the Cuban exiles. It's also possible, based on the Echeverria file, that some Jewish people, likely linked to Meyer Lansky, may have provided some funds to Cuban exiles at some point. But aside from the Echeverria document, the proof isn't there for that claim either. For me, I am now taking Israel off the board as a primary plotter in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Next time on Solving JFK, we'll be joined by James Angleton biographer Jefferson Morley and discuss rebuttals and counterpoints to that information. After that, we'll be off for a short time before returning with a series that looks at whether the Soviet Union could have ordered the hit on President Kennedy. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.